I'm Alex. My name's Kira. And my journey, my experience with the steps has been entertaining and interesting. And unlike a lot of people, I didn't come to Narcotics Anonymous because I didn't come to recovery because I felt that my life was unmanageable. My story is that I was born into a family that tried for 6.5 years to have me, and I was a loved child. I was born into a family that was emotionally very sick, and who presented a face to the world that they were like the Cleavers. And so I grew up not trusting myself. I grew up not trusting anyone else around me. And golly, but that's a horrible way for a child to grow up. I did, you know, what all of us have done. I sought relief from my feelings through chemicals. And I wanted a lot of relief from my feelings. And you know the story. I came to a point in my life where I always had one friend who was a little farther down the road than I in addiction. And so I could look at her and I could say, when I get that bad, I'll quit. You should really look at this, Linda, because, you know. And see, I knew about the disease. I'd watched my parents, my family members die from the disease of addiction, and we call it something else. We call it tragic accidents. We call it heart attacks. We call it, you know, we call it a lot of different things. And I had watched my mom go through DTs when I was in my early teens. I'd watched my mom self-medicate and be just unable to cope with life. I watched my dad attempt to drink himself to death, and after I got into recovery, he succeeded. And through all of that, you know, I went to another fellowship and to live with myself, to live with my family members, and I read everything that I could read about the disease of alcoholism, and I felt that knowledge equaled power. And because I knew so much and made it a point to educate myself, I felt, well, I knew that I would see it if I ever crossed that invisible line that they talked about with alcoholism. And, you know, that's a clue today as to my insanity, you know. I'll see it if I ever cross this invisible line. But at the time, it made perfect sense. And that's like the story of my life. At the time, it made perfect sense. There were extenuating circumstances, and it made perfect sense. When my first experience with recovery was in a family program, and then when I was in my early, well, not so early 20s, it seems early now, but at the time I felt like I was older than dust. I went into a treatment center, and I didn't go into the treatment center because I felt like I needed treatment. I went into the treatment center because my best friend was there, and I knew she needed support, and because I could take sick leave to go into treatment, and they had a swimming pool and 440 wooded acres, and it was a new program and fairly unstructured. I was like, hey. And I was in a marriage at the time in which my communication was real good. The night before I went, it was supposed to be my day off the next day, and I remember laying in bed with my husband, my current husband at that time, and he said, well, what are your plans for tomorrow? And I said, well, I'm going to go down to the treatment center. And he said, well, what for? And I said, well, for about 28 days. And, yeah, well, dinner was in the fridge, as a matter of fact. And I went to this treatment center, and, you know, I was just brimming over with willingness to change. At least it seemed like it at the time. And I did things like, you know, everybody had their little job that they had to do, and they assigned me a job, and it really pissed me off because my insurance was paying for me to be there. You know, you want me to work too? Please. And they assigned me a couple jobs, and, you know, one was to wipe up coffee, and, you know, I was like, well, yeah, that guy over there should do that. You know, maybe he'd figure out to only fill his cup half full. And after a couple different jobs, you know, clean out ashtrays, I don't smoke, please. After a couple jobs, they asked me, you know, they were so kind to me. They asked me, well, what would you like to do? And, well, I wouldn't mind straightening up the magazines over here. And so that translated into, you know, put those back when you're finished with them. What do you think, I'm your mother? And that was service. You know, obviously they needed someone to tell them what to do. And that was Carol. Yikes. And it's real good for me to remember that was Carol. I didn't get clean while I was in treatment. What a surprise. I had my car there. I had drugs in my car. You know, minor reservations, okay? And I got clean a few months afterwards, a couple months afterwards. But it was a beginning for me. It worked out so that people who had been in the treatment field when my mom was in treatment were there, and I was really able to begin to see that, you know, maybe I couldn't see it when I crossed that invisible line, and maybe I was in for trouble if I continued. So I went home, and I started going. They had introduced me to another 12-step fellowship. You guess which one. And I looked at the steps, and hey, no problem. I can do this. You know, they told me I needed to admit that I was powerless over alcohol when my life was unmanageable. And well, since I'm not drinking, no problem. You know, I just won't drink, and, you know, no problem with powerlessness if you don't do it. And my life is unmanageable. Well, my life wasn't that unmanageable, and, you know, it's okay. And I'm through the steps, you know. I'd look at them, and, well, I was never really insane, so I, you know, restored to sanity. I'm there. And the God thing, you know, I had a background in church, and I'm there. In the inventory business, I did like the Reader's Digest version of an inventory, and it was like the greatest story ever told. I really wish that I still had that. And on to the steps, and I knew my character defects had been removed because I wasn't using anymore, no problem. And it was time to tell other people how to do this. You should recover, darn it. And I luckily for me, I kept coming back, and I listened. Not real well in the beginning. People said things in meetings like, don't have any, relationships with the opposite sex for a year, and keep things simple, and don't get too serious. And so I decided to not have any serious relationships with the opposite sex for a year. And I made up for at least a year, and I made a plan, okay, and I set myself up so that it was absolutely impossible for me to have a serious relationship with a man. And I had Mr. Monday, Mr. Tuesday, Mr. Wednesday. And it just made sense to me at the time. And I developed, we have a way of fitting in. Wherever we go, feeling like you don't belong, but fitting in, learning what you're supposed to say and how you're supposed to act. And I would go to meetings and I learned to talk about steps. And then I couldn't let anybody into my personal life because then you'd know that I was just full of shit. And I couldn't have that. It was a process for me, the first step, and still is an incredible process for me. It wasn't until I'd been clean for 3 years that I was introduced to Narcotics Anonymous. And we'd had NA meetings in my area, and I was from Flint then. And people in these other fellowships had told us, if you want to talk about drugs, go to Narcotics Anonymous. And so that's what we did. And, imagine an NA meeting where the focus is not about recovery. The focus is about what drugs you used and how much and the insanity of your life. And that turned into, well, I can top this one. And we really looked at NA as a way to channel people into this other fellowship. And at the time, I also found another fellowship where I could deal with my emotions because I started to feel like I was just powerless over my emotions. And so I was a cross-addicted alcoholic with emotional problems, trying to keep things simple. Which first step is really first? Now that was a challenge. And in my early recovery, I had not taken care of myself. I'm learning today, and it's been a process to learn really how to care for myself, how to care about myself, and how to care for myself. And I ran myself ragged and made myself sick, and I got mono, and that progressed into something else, and I didn't know what. And I was going to doctors, and they thought that maybe I had some pre-leukemic condition, and then they started talking to me about Hodgkin's disease or something that they called acquired immune deficiency syndrome, and that sounded rather serious, but there wasn't a whole lot known about it at the time. And I started to really get scared. My brother died after I got clean, and he died from a drug overdose. And I think that was my first my first spiritual awakening as far as the second step went. My brother died from a drug overdose, and I wanted to use drugs. And that was my first real feeling and total gut awareness that my thinking was insane. We saw some flyers circulate around about a convention in Georgia, and you know, my first reaction was, why would anybody want to go to Georgia for a convention? But I kind of wanted to run away from myself for the weekend, and so I packed up my large literature, you know, big blue book that I had, and you know, this other stuff, and thought, okay, I'll go for this convention. Should be a fun time. And if I had known what I was going to run into there and how my life was going to change, I'm here to tell you that I would have never went. I would, who knows what I would have been, but I would have been scared to death. And I went, and I didn't get the Narcotics Anonymous that I've come to understand from the podiums that time at the convention. I got it in the hallways, and I got it outside. But my first experience with this, and you know, again, I'm just full of open-mindedness when I'm going. I was introduced to clarity of language when I met this addict, and you know, I reached out my hand. Hi, I'm Carol. I'm from Flint, Michigan. And he pushed my hand away, and he said, I'm an NA. I hug. And I'm hugging him, and I'm thinking, well, fuck you. Spiritually, of course. And he asked me about my time on the program, and I said, well, I've been sober for 3 years. And he said, this little grin, and he said, you know, I looked up a dictionary definition of the word sober, and the dictionary told me that it meant to be moderate, serious, somber, and not drunk. And I really don't like to limit myself in that way. Oh, please. And, you know, I was looking around thinking, are they all like this? It's going to be a really long weekend. Okay. I've been straight for this long. And this little grin again, and he said, you know, I don't come to functions to talk about sexual preference. Okay, what is it we're looking for? And I got my first NA language lesson. And my mind was telling me, reject this, you know, reject this, what this little asshole was saying. How dare he? And my awareness is like, oh, this is the truth. I hate it when this is the truth and I don't like it. And, you know, I heard that. And that weekend for me, I had some incredible spiritual awakenings. And one of them was that I was powerless over my addiction. Not all of these things outside of myself, not people, places, and things, not drugs, not all of this outside stuff. I was powerless over addiction that was inside me. I wasn't powerless over the substance. I was powerless over the way my thinking can lead me to justify and rationalize picking up that substance because, hey, I know so much, and it'll be okay. I met people that weekend who talked to me about commitment to NA, and I'd never committed to anything in my life. I'd said, till death do us part, a couple times, and we were like long gone, and all of us were still alive. And I knew nothing about commitment and follow through. And people talked to me about following through, and they were talking about the program and the fellowship and the differences and how it had grown this much here because people had committed to it. And that weekend, I came to understand that my path was to make a commitment to Narcotics Anonymous, which effectively didn't exist where I was from. And somebody has told me, and I've since come to understand that it really does take a special kind of insanity to bet your life on something that doesn't exist. I've learned about the steps through my interactions with people in recovery and with service work. I'm the person that, had I been given an option, I would have never participated in service. You know, my philosophy all my life has always been, let someone else do it. And I realized that weekend that I was putting myself in a position that there would be no one else to do it. And I don't remember ever being so frightened as that weekend. The person that I had made that trip with, he and I had a personality conflict that only one of us knew about, and you know, I had made arrangements that if I couldn't stand the drive back with him, somebody was going to send me bus fare. And he made this same surrender that I did. And I remember looking at him and thinking, why him? You know, he's going to be my support when I go home. And I remember thinking, I can't do this. What am I going to do? Because I remember knowing that this was my path. That this fit for me. I didn't have to change any words. This was what I'd been looking for. And that this was where I belonged. And I'd never felt that way before in my life. This is where I belong. Willard will tell you stories about, you know, early service, but I never tipped over any tables. I really didn't, okay? I gave people looks that may have communicated to them that there was a threat of my tipping over tables, but I never actually did it. What I wanted to do was go home and give everybody what I just got. And, you know, because I'm Carol, you were all just supposed to take it and understand and surrender, and we were all going to live happily ever after, and that's not what happened. And what that did for me was gave me an opportunity to begin growing up, to begin facing life on life's terms, to begin feeling the need to apply the steps and the principles to my life. And that was about 3 years after I got clean. I had heard about writing the steps and sharing them, and what a wonderful experience that was for me. And to see another human being, after I'd talked about myself, to see another human being look at me and say, it's okay. Yeah, I've done that too. And I found some freedom. The surrender in the first step. A lot of people talk about that leaving them real empty, but I got my first glimpse of peace with that, my first glimpse of serenity. And And I came to, and I came to believe in a power greater than ourselves, certainly greater than me. Somebody had told me in early recovery, look at it this way, Carol, if there's not a power greater than you, we're all in trouble. And I, yeah, there's not something out there. We are deeply in trouble. And at first, and really now, the way that I hear God, the way that I hear this power greater than myself, my favorite way, the clearest way, is in a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And there's magic in our meetings. There's magic when, you know, a bunch of people that have a hard time looking at each other before, and, you know, nobody wants to read, and nobody wants to talk first, and, you know, when the sharing starts, and God comes in, it's magic. Sanity, was I insane? Yeah. Did I need balance in my life? You bet. And to me, the second step is about beginning to have balance, beginning to understand that I needed some balance. And the third step for me, how wonderful to be able to let go and let God for short periods of time. And I got so much from the literature and from seeing in the third step, this is a decision we cannot make often enough. You know, what that told me was that I'm a normal addict. When I make that decision and give whatever it is that I'm surrendering to my God, and then take it back. Okay, I'll handle it right now. You've done a good job so far. I can do it. Thanks for the help. Here, let me give it to you again, because this is getting real sticky. That's normal for an addict. I didn't have to feel the shame that I was carrying around about not working a perfect third step. And that's again the story of my life, is about carrying around shame. I was sexually molested when I was young. That continued, and after I was in recovery, I was aware that it wasn't just the one person that I had thought, that it was several members of my family. And so I was real familiar with shame, and I've carried it. It's been my best friend and my worst enemy, all wrapped into one. And the steps have allowed me to give up parts of that shame, a little bit at a time, and to be able to look in the mirror and say, you know, you're not so bad. And then finally to come to a point where I can look in the mirror and say, you're a fine human being. When I came to understand later that my first fourth step was like the beginning of a first step. And I had documented the unmanageability. And that brought me to a place where I could look at who I was and take stock and look at the things that I did that hurt me. And I could share that with another person and share that with my God. And I could own it and look at it myself. And finally not feel like I needed to hide my past, like I needed to run away from who I was and who I'd been. And service meetings, NA meetings were a wonderful place for me to practice my sixth and my seventh steps, because my character defects became obvious when I got into service meetings, because these people just wouldn't do what I thought they should do. And that brought out some real unattractive behavior. And I would leave those meetings and I would go home and feel bad about myself. And so, I was directed to look at, how could I act instead? How would I like to act? And so I, practiced acting like this instead. And instead of when the word sober would come up, like I do with my dogs today, they do something they're not supposed to do. That was me in meetings. Sober. And I began to practice keeping it on myself. Talking about my needs, my feelings, not talk about you're doing it wrong. You are screwing up big time. Looking at me and still looking at everybody around me. It was much more fun to look at everyone around me and shame you and, you're not okay, therefore I must be. But I found so much more peace when I started looking at me and changing my behavior. And the funniest thing happened. When I changed my behavior, the people around me began to change. And it was great. I went through this wonderful process about what's a defect, what's a shortcoming, what's the difference? This is the difference. No, this is the difference. And somewhere along the way, it just kind of dawned on me that it doesn't really matter. What matters is that I'm relieved from them. What matters is that I come to live in a way that I can look myself in the eye when I'm putting on eye makeup. I can look at another human being in the eye and not look down. I can behave in a way that I don't have to go back to my room later and when I'm by myself think, oh God, why did I do that? Oh, I can't believe I would do anything so horrible. My eighth and my ninth steps, I was aware of the people that I had harmed. Basically, that was anyone that got close to me. And my ninth step, my first spiritual awakening with the ninth step was with one of my mothers-in-law. And I knew that I owed her amends. And it was like, well, but I'll never go to that city and so I'll never see her. like that was somehow outside of me and like I wouldn't know or something. And I carried around a lot of shame about that relationship, and so my God put me in contact with her, put me in a hospital waiting room with my ex-mother-in-law. And my first reaction was, I'll pretend like I don't see her. And then I realized that I was pretending to myself that I didn't see her. just who are you pretending to, Gil? And who is this amends for anyway? And I gathered the courage to go over and begin an amends process with her. And I remember, and I looked a little different. I remember going over and standing in front of her and saying, Irene, and she looked at me and I said, it's Carol. And she said, oh, Carol, you can wait.
Good to see you, Mom.
And I sat down with her, and she was waiting to find out whether her mother had had a cancer that was going to kill her. And I sat with her, and I was given the opportunity to not only apologize for my behavior, but to actually be there for her. And what a gift. I was welcomed back into the family. And not that I really want to be a part of the family, okay, but I do. I want everybody from my past that I can have be glad to see me, to be glad to see me. I want people from my past to see who I am. I want them to know that miracles happen. I want them to know that God changes people. That the program of Narcotics Anonymous works. It works everywhere. It just works. I was put back into touch with, through her, with my ex-husband, and I was able to make amends to him. I was able to, I mean, and those were the biggies for me. And I was able to go to people and not only sincerely apologize, but to ask some people, is there anything that you can think of that I could do to make this right? And a couple people told me, yeah, never let me see you again. And I said, okay. And most, you know, a couple people said, well, pay me back the money you stole from me. Okay. And I was able to make some of those financial amends. There was one amend that really, really troubled me, and that was at one point in my life I had been living in a house where drugs and different armaments were sold, and we got one batch in that they told us, don't sell this to anybody you like, okay? And we sold this to some people out of town, and on the way home, these men that we sold it to overdosed, and they died in a car accident, and they died from an overdose. And, you know, I've since come to understand and forgive myself, because if it hadn't been me that sold them the drugs, it would have been somebody else, because that's what they were looking for. That's where the disease had them be. But how do you make those amends? How do you make amends to families who don't have their parent? How do you make amends to wives who don't have their husband? To mothers who don't have their children? And it was suggested to me early on that I go through a period of inconveniencing myself to do universal amends. And like any good addict, I felt like this was, you know, a hair shirt that I had to wear, and, you know, I make a great martyr, you know. And my service work became that hair shirt for a while, until somebody said to me, you know, I've seen a lot of people die from active addiction, but I've never seen anybody kill themselves with service work yet. And I had to begin to look at caring for myself, being with my life, the only copy of the basic text that somebody may have a chance to see or read. My tenth step has given me so much freedom. You know, at first it was about not wanting to say I was sorry. And so my pride, you know, I've learned that all my character defects and my assets are basically the same, different degrees. An aphthat can become a very, very painful defect. A defect can become a cherished asset. Different degrees and balance. What a concept. My 10th step, and looking at myself on a daily, on a minute by minute basis, and not only afterwards, but before, asking myself, when something happens, how do I want to behave in this situation, has given me just an incredible amount of not only freedom, but self-respect. Something that I never had any of. And my 11th step, I was so disappointed when the third step wasn't like drop kick me Jesus over the goalpost of life. And that I didn't just get it. I was disappointed that it was going to be an ongoing process. And today I love that process. I cherish that process. I can look around myself today and, like Greg said, I can see God in everything, in every person around me. I can see my God. And what a wonderful way to live. What a wonderful opportunity. You know, the steps weren't like an arc, like a ball and chain. Oh, I gotta do these steps. I've gotten to do these steps. I've been blessed with the opportunity to apply these steps to my life and to change my life. To change from the dictator to someone who cares about other people's feelings, who respects other people's beliefs, even if they're warped and I believe totally wrong. I respect your right to believe how you believe. That's amazing. And for me, the 12th step has been about having that spiritual awakening, having so many small spiritual awakenings, from putting my license plate on my car with my screwdriver and thinking to myself while I was doing it, maybe I can cope with life. To, you know, the big spiritual awakenings. This is insanity. You know, I have an ongoing need. I have an ongoing second step deficiency. That's the problem with my life. Somebody at one convention or another had stickers that went on a mirror. You are looking at the problem, and I loved that. And I looked at that as though you're looking at the problem, but you're also looking at the solution, because the problem lies within me, the solution lies within me too. The solution is in this literature and also in the experience of those people around us. And I was so relieved to hear Greg say that about the literature and about us not needing our old-timers, because I had really been feeling in my local area like I was unneeded and unloved, and because, you know, people would come to me and ask me about a few things, but gee, they do have answers in the literature. Gee. What a spiritual awakening. My opportunities to carry the message, to truly carry the message of Narcotics Anonymous, of freedom from active addiction, has come from working the steps, living the steps, applying the steps, practicing the steps, and looking at them not as though it was something that I was going to complete and be finished with, but as if it were the ongoing process that I get to work on and apply for the rest of my life, that it is. Carrying the message today for me is about living in a way that's true to myself. It's about showing up and sharing when I'm asked to. And asking people, you know, that I see that are struggling, can I give you some input? Not forcing myself on people. I've been married two more times in recovery, and when my first recovery marriage ended, I was blessed with the ability to be who I wanted to be and to treat that person like I would want to be treated, with only a couple of small exceptions. And I just had to put in a jab or two, okay? And to be able to walk through that and feel like I was okay with myself, like there was not a lot of shame, to not own his behavior, to not look at his behavior as a reflection of myself, as my inability to somehow meet his needs. The steps have given me the understanding that, golly, I can't meet anybody's needs. You know, it's an inside job. We all have to do it for ourselves. And we can gather from people around us, and it's such a treasure, such a blessing to be able to gather from people around us and apply what fits. Recently, I've been rolling some of those stones up the way and letting them roll back on me and rolling some of those stones. And I've been in a period of total amazement. In Thanksgiving time this year, I'm going to celebrate 20 years clean. And I've been in a period of, how did this happen to me? How did I get so lucky? And what do I really know anyhow? Because the more I know that I don't know. And instead of being ashamed of that, it's okay. I'm married again, and I got an opportunity to have a family again. Part of my story is that I could never have children, and I've always just desperately wanted children. Instead, I've always married children. And I married a man with three teenage daughters, and I had such great hopes. I had such great hope that I would be able to give them the things that I so desperately needed as a teenager. And you can't give to somebody what they don't want. You can try and you can try and you can try all the different ways that you can think of, but it just can't be done. And so that stone's rolled back over me a couple times, and what I finally realized that I was going to be able to give them was, and probably the greatest gift that I could give them was to leave their father when he started using, and to show them that no matter how much you love somebody, it's not okay to accept unacceptable behavior. It's not okay to put yourself at risk because you love somebody. And the last week before I came here was spent packing and leaving my home and creating a new home for myself. I can't accept unacceptable behavior long term. I didn't get clean. I didn't practice these principles to live in a home where I would be verbally abused and put at risk. Why would I want to do that? And what's wonderful for me about my life today is that, you know, I still have this ongoing need for the second step, and I'm still an addict, and I still behave like an addict. But I can forgive myself, and I can accept that today. And how amazing that is. How totally amazing that somebody like me can recover from the disease of addiction. That somebody like me can learn to accept myself, because my biggest character defect is hurting myself with my totally unrealistic expectations of who I should be. I should be the perfect person. Again, my ongoing need for the second step, you know, second step deficiency. And it has been for me a process of simplification, and how wonderful that is to be, you know, working and thinking and...
Thinking, uh-oh, yes.
And to have a thought come and have it go and think, phew, boy, am I glad I didn't have to act on that one. I was doing some gardening a few weeks ago, and, you know, I was thinking about my life and how normal it seems. And I thought, uh-oh, duck. Maybe I'm not an addict. Maybe I never really was an addict. And how wonderful it is today that the next thought behind that was
Carol, right, Carol? And Prince Charming is on his way to rescue you. Fairy tales are fairy tales.
My recovery has led me to a place where I was able to go back to school, and I was able to learn, and I was able to look at my life and say, what do I want to be for a while I'm growing up? And, you know, we do have that, and I have. You know, I can look at anything from like 15 different sides. What about this? What about this? And somebody said to me at some point, you know, you have a great mind. Too bad you don't work in the legal field, because that would mean, you know. And I thought, And so I majored in legal assisting, and I work in a law office today.
I work in a law.
I talk to judges, you know. I talk to my lawyer boss, and he respects what I have to say. I manage his office. And I'm capable of doing that because of the steps. And I work in an environment where I can share my recovery with people who quite obviously need to hear about recovery. And I've been able to be the only copy of the basic text that some people will ever see, and to be a darn good copy of it. And that's amazing to me. Part of my story is also that I, in recovery I've had to learn to cope with not only the disease of addiction, but I found out that I had hepatitis and two viruses of hepatitis and almost died from hepatitis. And then I developed chronic fatigue and immune dysfunction syndrome and now chemical sensitivities. And it's been a challenge to live with that in recovery. And at one point, I was having just a tremendous difficulty accepting that I was going to have these limitations for the rest of my life. And you people have taught me, you know, the sects have taught me that sometimes it's necessary to take a step out and find somebody that can relate, to find somebody that I can share with, to find somebody and to focus on people who have had a tougher time with it than I. And I did what they call in my area buddy training. And the AIDS Foundation in my area had training so that I could be somebody's buddy. And they paired me up. It was a miracle. They paired me up with an addict who had never heard anything about recovery. And he was in the final stages of AIDS. And he kept saying to me, "Man, why do you do this? Why do you do this?" And I kept saying to him, "Thank you for allowing me into your life. Thank you." And we talked about recovery, and we talked and we talked, and he worked through the first three steps. And when he did his third step, he was able to let go. And he was able to let God take him. And I was able to be there when it happened. What an incredible gift. And what I tried to tell him before he left us was that what he was giving me was focus. And what he was giving me was incredible gratitude for my limitations and for how really they're not limitations, they're gifts, because they've made me a different person than I would have been if I could have run away from myself. They've helped me to go more deeply into myself and to learn to live in my skin when I couldn't do other stuff to get out of it, to get out of my feelings. You know, he helped me so very, very much. And my God has continued to put people into my life like you people who have helped me, have self-worth when I could share recovery with you, who have helped me accept what seemed to be the unacceptable and to transmute that into a powerful gift. To transmute all of the pain and all of the shame into strength and courage. Into the kind of courage that can really, really, you know, courage is fear that said its prayers. And I really like that definition. To be able to feel the fear and do it anyway. To be able to walk through, "I can't do this, I can't do this," because that's my first reaction, "Oh, I can't do this." And my second reaction is, "I can't, but we can." And my God helps me, and the people around me help me walk through what, by myself, I could not walk through. I had one period of time when my my husband told me that he'd had an affair with another man, and I found a lump in my breast, and the paint was peeling off my car, and I had to move, and somebody broke into my house and stole just my stuff while I was moving, okay? And my mother was ill and in Michigan, and I was in Virginia, and those were just the, you know, the biggies, and there was, you know, some other little stuff that was going on, and I walked out of the door one Friday morning and my car was gone. And I've learned to not ask, what else could happen? Oh, okay, I'll show you. And people in my fellowship, you know, when I was relating this, just kept saying, how are you walking through this? What, how do you do this? You just do the next right thing. You just do the next thing that you have to do. That's life on life's terms. You do what you can, and then you do what you can. And, you know, anything that doesn't kill you really does make you stronger. I'm a strong, capable woman. And that's a miracle. I'm a loving, giving, caring person. And that's a miracle. And whatever I die from, I have faith today that it's not going to be active addiction. I felt so cheated when I left this other fellowship where they had 12 promises. We only have one promise for me. Until I realized that one promise is everything. It's the world. It's knocking out pieces of the Berlin Wall. It's sharing with people where you don't speak the language and finding a way to communicate. It's the world. It's living in your own skin and liking it. So grateful. This is the first time because of school and my job and my family. And my obsession with those things. It's the first time I've been able to come out of the state in, I don't know, 5 years maybe. And what an incredible gift it's been for me to be able to be here and to be able to be surrounded by loving, caring people who are doing the same thing that I want to do, who are learning how to apply spiritual principles, who are committed to recovery. I gotta share just one more thing. I was able to come, you know, and I decided to drive down. I can't get on an airplane full of people with perfume and cologne and deodorant and, you know, those things. They overwhelmed me today physically and they made me ill. So I drove down and I gathered my receipts and I turned in my receipts and they reimbursed me. And a little while later, you know, Paul came over and he said, we're so sorry. I'm sorry we didn't hear the woman to speak. What is it? We're so sorry we asked you. You found a tape. What? Because sometimes, you know, there still is this, oh my God. And he said, you know, we reimbursed you for one way. It's like, oh, I get to go home too. And that's real neat for me because for a lot of different reasons. But the main one being that part of my story is that materialistic things, money, property, prestige, in the past have been so incredibly important to me. And today, I need money in order to be able to live. But hey, you know, I've learned that I really don't need that much. Now, you might not know it by seeing me, the process of my moving, because I'm one of those collectors, you know, and I've got all this stuff. I decided when I was moving this time that it really should be illegal for one person to own all this stuff. Collections of this. Boxes and boxes and boxes of NA stuff. I really don't need that much to live. When I was leaving my home, you may have heard about this hurricane that was coming through. And I live in Hampton, Virginia now, and that is right on the coastline, and I live on the water, on tidal water. And when I left my home, I didn't know if I was going to have, for sure, if I was going to have a home to go back to. And hurricanes have taught me a lot about what's important and what's not. And for this one, I took some stuff upstairs so that if it flooded, you know, it wouldn't get all gunky. And I packed my texts and my treasured literature, you know, and my copies of the text from here to there. I packed those in waterproof boxes and took them upstairs, and I packed things away. But I left, and as I was looking away, you know, looking around when I left and closing the door, it was just stuff. Just stuff. And what's important to me is life. What's important to me is my life, your life, the lives of those delightful little doggy creatures that I brought with me. That's what's important. Everything else is just stuff. And that's an awareness that's pretty neat too. Thank you so much for your service, for finding this wonderful, wonderful, delightful place where I could come and meet so many lovely people and meet my God in every one of you, where I could have time to myself to be quiet, where it wasn't real structured and thank you so very, very much for allowing me the opportunity to share just a little bit of what is just so absolutely amazing to me. Recovery, freedom from active addiction. The solution for which has eluded us for so long.